We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
Today in our hour-long climate cast, we're going to talk about how countries are making some big commitments in Paris to lower projected greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. says it will cut emissions 26% below levels in 2005 by 2025. And in a week when Beijing issued its highest pollution alert, China's gas emissions will start to drop by 2030. But if the U.S., China, and other big emitters are going to make those targets, and we don't know what the final deal is going to look like, corporations and businesses are going to have to do their share. Will they? Two guests today with some analysis. Paul Huttner is with us as well, and we'd like your thoughts. How much does it matter to you as a consumer, as a customer, that the larger companies you do business with actively commit to a carbon reduction plan? You have some power here as a consumer. I'm interested in whether you use it, whether you think about it. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We've got a discussion going on at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner is with us, and he joins us from the Weather Lab. And hey, Paul, I understand you have a little bit of a cold, so welcome. I'm glad you could be with us today.
Hey, thanks, Carrie. I'm doing well. And an interesting day. We're on the verge of maybe a historic global event here with what's going on in Paris. So it's crunch time. They're in the final push now.
Eric Roston is with us. He's sustainability editor for Bloomberg in New York, and he's with us from New York. And Eric, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Richard Eidlin is VP of Policy for the American Sustainable Business Council. He attended the Paris Climate Talks. He's back in the States now. And Richard, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Richard, since you were in Paris, I thought we should start with you. Give me a sense of what role that corporations are playing in Paris. I understand they've brought a lot of lobbyists to the meeting. What are they doing?
Well, companies large and mid-size, and even some small companies from across the globe are there participating as observers. So just some quick context, 195 countries have formal delegations in the discussions and are hammering at an agreement. And along with those delegates, of which there are about 10,000 from governments, there are over 20,000 observers, and the business community is well represented. Very large multinationals like Total and Bank of America and Citigroup, as well as smaller companies, are there lobbying, advocating. They have exhibits, they have booths, they're running workshops. In our organization, the American Sustainable Business Council, which represents a 250,000 U.S.-based companies, was there to make a strong case for action on climate change as we view it to be a fundamental risk.
Okay. Eric, one person's and one company's action is another person's not enough or too much. Give me a sense of what role you think businesses are playing as this agreement starts to come together. I mean, would some businesses be there pushing for lighter targets, you know, something that isn't going to affect the industry as quickly or as seriously? What's your take on that?
Businesses are there. I think they themselves acknowledge that they have a limited voice. With 195 countries in the room, having another 6,000 businesses isn't going to help matters. But I think it's a great focal point to show where we are in business development on this issue. And for many years, we've seen companies take on voluntary commitments. I think the most interesting development, which we had an update on this week, is that companies are actually taking the policymakers' goal, which is to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius, and they're trying to actually scientifically determine what their role, what their contribution to that is, and setting their plans against an empirical goal rather than a marketing goal.
Yeah, Eric, explain what you mean by that.
Well, so the thing that is organizing all these countries' attention is this international agreement that we should try to limit global warming to no more than 2 degrees
right.
Celsius.
Right.
That's the line in the sand that the scientists say. Beyond that, it's way too dangerous. So while policymakers are trying to put together this huge jigsaw puzzle to figure out how they can achieve that, businesses, many of them, want to do more to help than just lobby or show up with a booth or talk to media. And so what they're doing is they're looking at the science and they're looking at work done by the International Energy Agency, and they're saying, okay, well, we know that our sector pollutes this much, and we know that by 2050, our sector is only going to be able to pollute this much. And we know our role in our sector, so therefore we can calculate specifically what our greenhouse gas cuts should be.
Yeah. Carrie, let me give you a more specific example.
Okay.
So in conversations with companies there, including Ben & Jerry's and Facebook and Google, those companies have decided to actually take a step on their own, which is to internalize the price of carbon. So they have set an internal operational price. In the case of Ben & Jerry's, it's $10 a ton. So when they make investment decisions, they are accounting for the cost of the carbon they emit as a result of their supply chain. So those companies, as Eric said, are beginning to take very concrete steps. There is a tremendous amount of activity, regardless of the sector that companies are in, whether it's financial services or manufacturing or outdoor recreation, where companies recognize that climate change is just a fundamental risk to the way they do business, and they're trying to get ahead of the curve and understand that without action, the cost of doing business to them because of rising insurance costs, energy spikes, all that's going to make doing business in the future more expensive for them. So they're actually there advocating for national governments to take specific actions.
Paul, this is something that we talked about. It's been months ago now, but we had an executive from Ecolab in the studio where we were saying that companies in our region where we're really, you know, seeing some of the leading edge of consequences of climate change cannot wait for some kind of national or international policy on this, right?
Yeah, and you're reading my mind, Carrie, as I'm sitting here listening to Richard talk about this. You know, we've even talked to the head of Cargill, General Mills, Best Buy, Target. These are companies that are all have signed on with 81 major U.S. companies to the White House's Action Climate Initiative. So this is happening, Carrie, faster than I think I thought it would when we started talking about ClimateCast here about 3 years ago. And I'm curious to follow up with Richard, too, in Paris, because I've been following the late developments there, and I see there's this high ambition coalition that's taking that 2 degrees Celsius cap and goal and talking about 1.5 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. So tell us where the latest negotiations stand there as we head into the last 24 hours here in Paris.
Right. So I left Wednesday morning, and since then, the first draft, which was 46 pages, has now been chiseled down to 27, which is significant progress in the way the UN conducts business, which is to create a consensus document. This 1.5 Celsius degree increase as the maximum that's permissible is being pursued by a whole range of countries, including the United States at this point. So Secretary John Kerry has made it clear that the U.S. will do what it can to push for a lower emissions threshold. Many companies are eagerly watching this, anticipating, because it affects their investment decision process. And a concept that we might all want to just touch on briefly is called the carbon delta. And it looks at the difference between the actions that would have to be taken if the target was set at 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius. And the longer we wait, say many executives, I was having a conversation with the Norwegian company Statoil, for instance, they say the longer they wait, the more expensive the cost of capital will be because the remediation, the adaptation that they'll have to take will just get more expensive. So many, many companies, including the ones you just mentioned, are recognizing that action in the short term is actually much better for their economic prospects than waiting for years and years.
Eric, I want to bring you back in on this and talk about a carbon tax, because if you read a lot of the analysis and you listen to people like Elon Musk of Tesla, who I know has been in Paris and is saying the critical thing we need to do is correctly price carbon. Isn't that the measure that a lot of companies are not ready to accept, but the thing that would really make the difference? And this is something that the EU has already played with, right, has done this.
Yeah, and it's an important point that you bring up. Not only are—I would put aside for a second the companies that are afraid of it, companies that are pushing it off. I think it's not understood as widely as it might be how much of the world operates in an economy that has a carbon price. You mentioned Europe, and that was the first program. California, the U.S. Northeast, parts of Canada— a very interesting sort of almost clockwork of a ring of fire, you know, the ring of fire around the Pacific.
Right.
South Korea, Japan, parts of China, Chile, Mexico. There's a wide sweep of places that have carbon taxes. So it's already standard operating procedure in many places. And the reason why that is, and the reason I think so many economists agree that that is the right place to go, is just to, like, if I could just have a second to just very clearly state the climate problem in economic terms. And that is, it's free to put carbon dioxide, the exhaust from combustion, into the atmosphere, but it has a long-term social cost. The carbon price is the way to bridge the fact that we're polluting with the fact that physically it has a cost. And that's why that's still in consideration.
Yeah, and Carrie, if I could just quickly add to that, I attended a number of sessions that focused on establishing a price on carbon. So there's uniform agreement that establishing a price, whether it's through California system where there's a cap and trade or an actual tax, mm-hmm. which is what Canada's Ontario province has, everybody agrees that that is a necessity. And the reason it's so important is it sends a signal to the market, to investors, to consumers, to manufacturers, that, as Eric said, carbon's not free. We're paying for it by healthcare, additional healthcare costs, by insurance spikes, by weather damage, et cetera. And so having a tax on carbon establishes a much better understanding of what the real impacts are.
But Richard, when you say everyone agrees, well, Congress certainly doesn't agree.
Sure, sure. So there are members of Congress that don't agree with that, but what we're doing here in Washington, D.C., is working with a number of organizations, both Democrats and conservatives, who do appreciate that a tax on carbon is a very rational step.
But let me make the connection here. Congress doesn't agree, I assume, because members of Congress are hearing from constituents with a certain amount of power within and money within businesses who don't want a carbon tax. I mean, if members of Congress who were opposed to this were hearing from the CEOs of some of these companies who said, sure, we think this is a necessary thing, I think members of Congress would change their minds about it.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to see a significant shift after Paris, where many American companies will be interested in articulating that view and coming to D.C. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island was there at the COP21. He spoke with a number of U.S.-based companies in the room and asked those companies and organizations like the American Sustainable Business Council for help in making the case. A carbon tax in the U.S. could be quite popular because what it would do is it would reduce corporate income tax and personal income tax. So it would essentially trade one tax for another in order to solve a large problem.
You know, Eric, I really can't see the horizon where a carbon tax, I mean, even when President Obama had Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, they were loath to bring this up. You've got powerful utility companies, by the way, who oppose this, most of whom oppose this right now. I don't see the political
I agree with your assessment of the present, but I do see the horizon. Polling over Americans polled over the last year or two show a clear majority of Americans understand that the world is warming and that mankind is largely responsible and that we probably should have policy to fix it. And you can argue, and you should argue, about what those policies might be. But I think Americans, the polling robustly shows, understand what's going on. The second point I would make is that when you look around the world, the Republican Party in the United States is the only major political party that denies climate change outright or denies that it's a problem that should be addressed. It's just, it's an anomaly that is so weird. It has been going on for so long.
It is weird, but I mean, they right now they control the House and the Senate. That's no small amount of power that they wield.
Right. And that's why I agree with your assessment of the present. But I do see something very interesting on the horizon. And what is on the horizon is the fact that we've had a Democratic president now for almost two full terms who has who's put in place through executive action many effective carbon regulations. So America has a pretty, choose your baseline, but a pretty aggressive suite of regulations to turn down carbon emissions. Now, what we're seeing in Washington, particularly from libertarians, who are just, whose main, tenet is freedom and particularly freedom from large government. Well, it turns out that libertarians in the Republican Party see all this new EPA regulation and are much and also see the soundness of climate science and say and are much more upset now about EPA regulation than they are about climate science. So, like, there's a new enemy in town in Washington, so and it's not climate science.
They'd rather have more control.
Regulation.
Yeah, and let me clarify this. When you and I said, and you were saying that the GOP is an anomaly when the rest of the world, I do want to say that there are members of the Republican Party who believe in climate change and who believe that it's human influenced. There are members of the GOP who don't believe in climate change. There are members who believe in climate change but don't think that it's been influenced by human activity. So there are different shades of opinions.
I would say that, like, climate science has been mature for so long. Like, it's my job, basically as a journalist to say the people who don't think climate change is happening are factually incorrect.
Yep.
The people who think that climate change is happening but humans aren't causing it are factually incorrect.
Yes, they are.
Do about it is
understood.
Is anybody's guess.
Yes,
like, there are no right or wrong answers, and what, if anything, you do about
it. But I don't want to broad brush the party, even if their beliefs about climate change are wrong. Okay, Let me tell our listeners what we're doing here, and then right back to you, Paul. If you've just tuned in to the conversation, we're taking note of what's happening in Paris as they come to the end of this 2-week meeting on climate change. And we're talking about the role that business has to play internationally at the talks, but also here in the United States. Richard Eidlin is with us. He's vice president of policy for the American Sustainable Business Council. He was in Paris, got back, left Paris on Wednesday night. Eric Rosten is with us, sustainability editor for Bloomberg in New York. And Paul Huttner, NPR meteorologist, of course, with us as well. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Hey, one of the things I was asking you to think about is, does it matter to you as a consumer or a customer that the companies you do business with actively commit to some kind of carbon reduction plan? You can weigh in by phone. You can weigh in on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. Paul, what did you want to say?
Well, I think you've hit on some really interesting levers here, and that's why I'm so interested in the trajectory of this sort of corporate acceptance and adoption of climate science. You know, any target that they set in Paris, whether it's 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2 degrees Celsius, I think some people look at that as a little bit symbolic. It really comes down to the science of what each country is able to do with their greenhouse gas emissions over the next 50 to 100 years. But my question is, and my sense is that those corporate levers are going to be the thing that ends up changing Congress's mind over the long term. And I'm wondering from our guests if they think that that trajectory is happening faster than we thought it might be happening 5 or 10 years ago.
Richard?
I think it is, in large part because, again, companies are recognizing that it's in their long, even their midterm interest to take action. So they see it as a risk. They want to get ahead of the curve. They want to reduce their uncertainty. So in Paris, it was fascinating to watch the large number of commitments that the financial services industry was willing to make to decarbonize their investment portfolio, that manufacturers were willing to make. These were all voluntary commitments that companies like Facebook and Google and Ben and Jerry's were there talking about the initiatives that they're voluntarily taking in order to improve their economic performance and, by extension, to influence policymakers. So the private sector was moving quickly, and that's not just in the United States, but you found examples across the world. Now, there is some greenwashing that's going on in Paris, of course, and some of the larger oil and gas companies and mining concerns were there, and they were arguing for a slower transition. But the same argument for let's go slow and be cautious was being made by some oil producers like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. So the private sector has a very important role to play, but it's ultimately going to be governments that dictate what the policies are. Those policies do influence what companies end up doing.
You know, Eric, I was thinking about this show when I heard a story, I think it was on NPR last week, about how China is developing new coal resources, which is, as you obviously know, a very dirty resource. And it made me wonder whether, when you've got industry like that and needs, I mean, China would say we're developing, we need that kind of energy. You've got a coal industry I know that's changing in the United States, but still pretty active. Do those kinds of industries wait, you know, to participate in this until they absolutely have to? Or are there, is there any indication that some of them, and I mean specifically utility and fossil fuel companies, are getting out ahead of this?
Good question, and very important this week. China, during the talks, has raised red flags about its concern about not being able to burn coal. Coal is getting clobbered for reasons that don't have to do necessarily directly, I think, with the decisions of the heads of utilities right now. And the two biggest reasons are natural gas and solar and wind energy, which in the marketplace are just killing coal. I think there's two things to keep in mind. One is this diplomatic legal route over who's going to have laws governing coal use versus the fact that, like in the United States, the thing that has allowed the new regulations to happen are cheap natural gas and cheap solar, which present an alternative. The third point I would make is the very real need of poor people in developing nations to gain access to modern energy. And the classic example there is India, mm-hmm. where there are more Indians without any kind of modern energy than there are Americans, full stop. So they need coal, they need something.
Right.
And Carrie, it's interesting to note, too, that this week China is literally choking in their own coal dust.
I mentioned that, Paul, at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, with these red alerts in Beijing. And that's very interesting timing. And, of course, you know, Eric is right about the solar boom and the clean energy jobs. I mean, they're expanding rapidly in the United States. And India has a choice to make as it goes forward. The question is how able are they to do that, whether they go with a cleaner energy future or rely on coal. That's very important to long-term emissions going forward.
Let me take
a
call.
If I can add one quick thing on top of that, I just want to emphasize how important that what Richard just said about India, and it's also up to us and investors around the world. India needs a huge amount of investment capital to make their solar plans work. So that's going to be something very interesting to watch.
Call here from David in Minneapolis. Hey, David, hi. Thanks for waiting. Question.
There are a number of companies, quite a few, well, I don't know, but out there that are working on scrubber technology, different approaches, and might it be worthwhile if corporate America, along with governments, could form a consortium similar to what Gates has done to just back this research
interesting,
and take it to the max? And then the other part of that equation is that once you do start scrubbing the carbon out of the atmosphere, you're going to have an enormous, huge mountains of gunk. And where are they going to put it? And then,
okay, let me get to the first part of your question, because Eric, will you address that, please?
Yeah, it's a very important point, and it's a very exciting field of endeavor right now. There are sort of embryonic technologies that can do one of two things. One is catch carbon dioxide as it leaves a coal smokestack. And the other is really, really scrub carbon dioxide out of ambient air, just out of the atmosphere itself. And it's true. He's absolutely right. Some of these technologies actually pull it down in this like black carbonous gunky material. And we should be so lucky to have the problem of where to put the gunk. So it's early days. Some of the technologies have been proven to work, and the businesses are just getting off the ground.
Mary in Minneapolis says online, I'd heard of a suggestion associated with Michael Bloomberg promoting financial disclosure by firms of their exposure to climate change risks. She wants to know, Richard, if you would comment on that. Are you familiar with it?
Yes. Yeah, so Mayor Bloomberg was there in Paris and spoke at a number of occasions about the importance for companies to disclose their carbon emissions and the cost that they incur, because that would give stock owners and shareholders a better understanding of the risk they're assuming. So Mayor Bloomberg's perspective is shared by a lot of people, that the more that the market understands the implications of investing in fossil fuels and the risks associated with it, that people will begin to move their dollars into cleaner energy investments. I will also just note that a number of countries, including the United States, actually now require companies to disclose the risks associated with carbon emissions. And this idea of transparency and giving the market more understanding of what the implications of climate change are is something that was actively being discussed in Paris.
That's really interesting. Eric and Paul, come in on this, because I actually think we've talked about this as well, that companies disclosing to shareholders how they're planning and what the cost of doing business as climate change increases. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Carrie, I think it's part of the broader tapestry that we've talked about many times here on ClimateCast, and that's, are we on the verge of sort of a climate change moonshot where as we do this transition from carbon-based fossil fuels to clean energy? The solar is a great example of that, with the cost dropping over 50%, and the amount of investment going into solar is increasing dramatically. So, I mean, there are people out there looking for climate change opportunity and investment, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see that going forward. I'm also curious what our guests think about big solar, for example. Follow the money. How fast is investment pouring into clean energy and solar?
So, Eric, would you address the first part of that, though, the disclosure to shareholders? Yeah. Then we can talk about solar.
It's the law. This initiative is very important, and of course, at Bloomberg, we particularly are sensitive to its importance. But it's an international effort to make more common something that's already embedded in U.S. law. And in 2010, during the first really full year of the Obama administration, the Securities and Exchange Commission came out with guidance for companies saying, look, you by law have to disclose certain things. here is a big document explaining how climate change fits into our materiality law.
Okay.
So what we just saw happen in Paris was a movement to internationalize that. Now, moving on to the solar question, which is just phenomenal. Like, I'll, you know, personally, like, I'm sort of a pessimistic person, right? maybe that's how I got into this to begin with. But the fact is that, like, the rate of change, the rate of the price drops in solar, in wind, the discovery of U.S. natural gas, which is a fossil fuel but much less polluting than coal, and, like, a dozen other things, if we really had time to get into it, all these things have happened, like, with mind-bending speed. Like, the energy is the most plodding, boring, infrastructure-heavy industry there is. But we've been seeing it move at the pace of technology, of like, internet technology in the last few years. It's breathtaking.
Carrie called from Sioux Falls. She heard our discussion about Republicans, and she says, Republicans don't believe in destroying the earth, but we believe that people or companies can't control everything that happens on Earth. And then Holly on Twitter here is saying that she heard the interview on NPR, Paul, with Senator Ted Cruz, mm-hmm. that he referenced scientific tests that show no temperature increase. I know you and I were both listening carefully to that interview. She yes. asks, what is he referring to and why is it wrong?
Well, I'll tell you what, Peter Glick from the Pacific Institute did a great fact check on this yesterday with that NPR interview. Cruz was almost unchallenged on these assertions, and virtually everything he said in that interview is scientifically inaccurate. And, of course, we've had Dr. Glick on from the Pacific Institute on ClimateCast before, and there's a great link to that on my Updraft blog that you can
Good.
See. You know, it's a common cherry pick. Some of the satellite data starting in the late 1980s, 1990s, 1998 actually, to try and say there hasn't been any warming since then. But you can't pick one part of the overall record and try to make that case when the overall record is overwhelming that it's happening. So the bottom line is Ted Cruz was factually inaccurate on just about everything he said on that interview yesterday.
And Carrie, if I could respond to the comment about Republicans, you know, the work that the American Sustainable Business Council does is to present the business case on climate change and any other issue where there's an economic benefit to be derived. So we work with Democrats and Republicans in Washington and state capitals across the country. And so we know from direct experience that many Republicans are, in fact, quite concerned about climate change. They see the local impacts. They see extreme weather affecting their communities. So they're looking for solutions as well, and I really think that the individuals who continue to claim that there is no such thing as climate change will be, they will be the dinosaurs in a very short period of time, and they will find that their views are really superseded by the market moving very quickly. So we work, again, with lots of different Republicans. There is a member of Congress, Representative Chris Gibson from upstate New York, who recently issued a letter signed by a dozen of his Republican colleagues who understands there's a problem and is looking for an efficient solution. And go back to Eric's point much earlier, many conservatives, because they don't want government to grow, are wary of EPA's clean power rules and instead see some type of national carbon tax as a more viable solution and a more equitable one as well. So I think Senator Cruz is catering to to an election cycle at this point.
Well, Richard, stipulated everything you said. But 2 weeks ago, I see Chris Christie get on MSNBC,
mm-hmm. well,
who is not perceived to be on the spectrum quite right where Senator Cruz is, and he feels totally free to say that while he believes climate change is happening, he doesn't believe that humans have had any influence of it. I don't blame some people who have not dug into the science of this yet, wish they would, but they haven't, for being confused. When you have people at that stature feel obviously free to say those kinds of things.
Well, I think that I agree with that, but I think Governor Christie is being irresponsible, having experienced Hurricane Sandy.
Yes.
And Governor Christie is willing to talk about extreme weather and the unpredictability of weather patterns. And I think, you know, he also, if he gets the nomination, will pivot to a more reasonable stance come August or September of next year.
Richard, I really appreciate the time this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Eidlin is VP of Policy for the American Sustainable Business Council. He was at the climate talks. We're going to continue our discussion, taking more of your calls and your questions here. And then we're going to get the latest from the BBC in Paris on where the negotiations are at. 651-227-6000 to join us, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and to Phil Picardi now. And Phil, what are you watching?
Hi, Carrie. Volkswagen executives say a small group of its engineers began working as early as 2005 on emissions cheating software. Chairman Hans-Dieter Petsch says the engineers were unable to find a technical solution to U.S. emission standards within their time frame and budget, so they came up with software that manipulated the results. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has scrapped a planned trip later this month to Israel. Trump tweeted that he will reschedule it at a later date, quote, after I become president. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been urged to cancel the visit after the uproar over Trump's call to keep Muslims from entering the U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has won the endorsement of a union representing federal workers, adding to her labor advantage over rival Bernie Sanders. The American Federation of Government Employees Union says it's backing Clinton over the Vermont senator in the Democratic primaries. Applications for U.S. jobless aid climbed last week, but the number of Americans seeking benefits remains close to historic lows and a positive sign for the job market. The Labor Department says weekly applications for jobless aid rose 13,000 to a seasonally adjusted 282,000. Police in Geneva are searching for suspects in connection with the deadly attacks in Paris, France in November. Swiss security officials say authorities have flagged suspects who could be in the city. And the Todd Haynes 1950s romance Carol has landed a leading 5 nominations, including Best Dramatic Picture for the 73rd Golden Globes, also up for Best Drama, Mad Max Fury Road, The Revenant, Room, and Spotlight. More ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:44.
Did you catch our biggest book show of the year yesterday at 9 o'clock? Man, it's trending on Twitter. If you haven't seen this list and you're looking for a great book, check it out. I've tweeted out links. You can find it at NPR News and the thread. Just search it.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by the Carolyn Foundation, working to support clean energy systems across the Upper Midwest. More information is available online at carolynfoundation.org.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing, specializing in all types of boiler, hydronic, and radiator heating systems, also specializing in drain repair. Live operators are available 24 hours a day. BenFranklinPlumbing.com, the punctual plumbers.
Back to our conversation now on business and the climate talks in Paris. Eric Roston remains with us from Bloomberg and Paul Huttner with us, of course. And a question here, Eric, from Dennis in Scandia. Hey, Dennis, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to make a couple of comments that business wants to improve their bottom line. People call the big businesses job creators. The last thing they want to do is create a job. And the last thing that they want to do is spend money that isn't going to add to their bottom line. And that's what's going to happen. The minute they admit that there is a carbon problem and we're causing it, then they have to do something about it. You know, they continue to say, well, we don't want big government. But if you go back and check the numbers under every administration, Republican administration, the debt has gone up. So they're spending more money, but they're calling the Democrats tax and spend. So I think it's strictly a financial problem. And you get somebody like Christie who says, well, he believes that we're warming up, but we're not causing it. He's trying to play both sides of the street.
Eric, what would you say to that?
Well, first, my favorite thing about Christie's performance at the recent debates was that he touted New Jersey's rank as the number 3 top solar state. But he did not tell the Republican audience that that was almost entirely driven by generous New Jersey state subsidies.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, there's New Jersey's. We don't have to get into that. But I think, well, ultimately, you're right. You are correct, sir. And the bottom line is what drives companies. It's what enables them to exist. And so that's not changing. But what's interesting that is changing is the rest of the world. You know, new kinds of products, new kinds of services are attracting capital, are attracting corporate interest. They see opportunities there that are opening up as things change for better or for worse. Old things they do are no longer fruitful. Coal, burning coal, being one of them. And you know, the reason that you see so many consumer-facing companies at the head of the corporate movement is that consumers are driving it too. What people think is just as important in some ways as the actual fact of climate change when businesses are deciding what to do next.
Paul, two questions off Twitter here. One for you. A listener heard us talking about Hurricane Sandy and said, isn't a hurricane weather and not the climate? We get this question a lot, so I look to you to clarify this.
Well, the answer is yes, of course it's weather. But the thing about Sandy that is climate and climate change driven, according to some folks who have done attribution studies on this, is the pattern of the jet stream that time of year, this Arctic amplification we've talked about, where the jet stream is undergoing changes because of climate change, and it was in a very unusual configuration in late October when Sandy hit. Normally, those storms are steered out to sea. This one was sucked back into the New Jersey coast. The other thing that's very demonstrable with Sandy, the Atlantic Ocean temperatures were much warmer than average, and that helped Sandy stay stronger than it otherwise would have right on its trip into the Jersey coast.
Isn't that also what happened, Paul, with Patricia, the hurricane that came in into Mexico?
Yes, absolutely, and we're seeing that more and more now. The Pacific hurricane season this year was just insane, and we saw some of the highest numbers and the highest intensities of storms and some of the highest water temperatures. It's warm water that fuels those storms. And just interesting really quickly to touch on Eric's points about jobs. You know, we often don't talk enough about the transition to new jobs when it comes to climate change. We're seeing that in Minnesota. We're over 15,000 clean energy jobs here, and they pay 42% higher than the Minnesota average. They pay an average of $71,000 a year. So, you know, we're seeing these booms happen. We're going to see new jobs and a new economy centered around growth from adapting to climate change.
You know, and Eric, this is what's so interesting to watch in what's happening in China, because I mentioned what's going on with coal, but I don't want to leave people with the impression that China doesn't get exactly what Paul just described, the investment in the industry and how booming and economically viable that can be.
Yeah, I you know, I think if I had one wish for how this conversation is pursued in the U.S., like, we're here talking about this for an hour. This is extraordinary. I love it. And it allows us to acknowledge complexity that that just isn't mentioned in sort of soundbite, you know, quick article journalism. And that is, China is doing a lot of things. China understands this problem. You know, like, China's government is not filled with lawyers like ours. They're filled with engineers and scientists. So they get it. And they want to move as fast as they can. They're probably moving much faster than anyone would have thought 5 years ago. But they also have enormous, enormous poverty. And they are going to need to continue to burn coal to just keep their country together. And so that complexity is what makes this such a hard problem. I'm so glad that you have given, you know, everyone an opportunity to think about this stuff.
I guess I didn't phrase that exactly right, but what I was thinking of is, even as they have these obstacles that you've just talked about, China is making the kinds of investments. Well, President Obama has talked about it. I mean, they're investing in the renewable industries and at a rate that the United States is far behind.
That's,
I mean, look at the bet they're making on this, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yep. That's right, and it's Chinese production, in fact, that allowed those solar prices to fall. So they really are driving this, and I think they probably don't think of it as making a bet. You know, they think of it as a transition that has to happen.
Listener says here, this is kind of interesting, another Eric, who says, to help make the public more conscious on their carbon consumption, would it help to have the labels on products that show the amount? I don't know if you could even break that down. But
so would that be like protein, sugars, and carbon? That'd be right on there, too.
But I hear what he's getting at there, the awareness, right? The very constant, subtle awareness of this. I don't know, Eric, could that work?
I love the question because there's been a lot of behavioral research into what helps people understand or what prevents people from understanding things that scientists are confident that are true. And I think it worked for some people. You know, I think that, I wish I could remember where I read a story recently about, it might have even been Canada, where they're thinking of putting labels on gas pumps saying that burning this gas puts this into the atmosphere. And, like, that's one approach, you know. And there are lots of approaches. Last week, I had a months-long project come to fruition. And this is some colleagues of mine and I at Bloomberg produced a national debt clock for climate change. It's a real-time estimate of the concentration of carbon dioxide.
Eric, I'm going to wrap this right here, but we'll get a link to your clock, okay? And
okay,
I'll tweet that out. Great to have you, Eric. I hope you'll come back. Really good to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Paul, feel better, and I'll see you in studio again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, Carrie.